mean that I'm going to be cutting out some things, so excuse the elision sometimes. I'm just pressed here, squeezing out my favorite material. I had an actual plan in my life to get interested in the question of women during World War II. It kind of happened to me rather than choosing to do so. The way it happened was that I came across some very curious passages when I was doing my general, more general work on the history of women's work. And I'll give you a few of those just to give you an idea of the sort of things that were beginning to strike my curiosity. Two people had studied the sociology of the Willow Run defense plant, and they made this remark. Realizing that working mothers needed to be sold on the advantages of using daycare nurseries, Mrs. Edsel Ford had arranged for educational movies on the subject to be shown in the women's restrooms at the bomber plant. When Henry heard of that, he vetoed the idea instantly. So that was that. More than 10,000 women were actually working in the bomber plant at the time. Mr. Ford made no move to get rid of them, but in his view of 1870s, women have no business working in factories. So working mothers who had no business in the factory anyway continued working in blissful ignorance of the advantages of daycare nurseries. That was one passage. Then I read back over Zora Neale Hurston's essay, Crazy for This Democracy, and she starts out wondering whether FDR had really meant to call America the arsenal of democracy, or whether he wasn't meaning that British arse and all, since she couldn't see fighting to protect the French right to subjugate the Indochinese, or the Dutch right to crush the Indonesians, or the British right to control the Malayans and the Burmese. Was this really what democracy was about? As she put it, the ass and all of democracy has shouldered the load of subjugating the dark world completely. And she goes on. Then I read those accounts of the growth of lesbian communities, both in civilian and in domestic life. We have a quote from a WAC officer in 1944. The Surgeon General's office in the latest circular letter, particularly for soldiers overseas, stressed that homosexual relationships should be tolerated as long as they were private, consensual, and did not disrupt the unit. The war emergency apparently made a lot of things possible. I read Rose Feld's account of Sophie Hollinsick, the patriotic immigrant household worker with a heart of gold. Her daughter Irene had gotten into trouble and was pressuring her boyfriend to marry her. Crying and begging hadn't worked, so Irene learned from what unions did, and this is how Sophie tells it. She knew there had been many strikes in Bridgeport. In front of the factories, men and girls, what you call them, pickers, no pickets, walk with signs. And then the bosses settle, right? She put a sign which says, George O'Donos is fair, unfair to baby. It's a banner. I have the, this is Sophie in front of the factory gate with her baby carriage. Irene made the sign herself and put it over the carriage. Every day, lunchtime, all dressed up fine, she'd go to the machine shop and she'd walk this way and that before the door. All the men would work with George, they'd come out, and when they see her, they laugh and they pat her on the shoulder. They say she's a great girl. At first, George, he'd get mad like hell, and then when he see the other men think Irene is pretty smart, he'd come out one day and he'd say, okay, kid, you win. I started to read more and more of these accounts, which did not fit into the received wisdom. Mr. Ford's patriotism didn't extend to allowing information about daycare centers, which might become a permanent fixture after the war, after all. And Hurston was speaking for a lot of blacks in this country, around 35%, polls estimated, who were not sure they'd be treated any worse if the Japanese conquered the U.S., who felt it more important to make democracy work at home than to concentrate on beating the Axis. And Sophie's Irene adopting union tactics to shame her boyfriend into capitulation. I began to wonder about this Rosie the Riveter. So I went to some of the secondary literature, the granddaddy of which is Chape's The American Woman in 1972. And there he argues that World War II was a real watershed event in the history of women's work and American values. The female labor force patterns were decisively altered. Paid work for women became more normal. More older married women would enter the labor force from then on. And for Chafee, this laid the groundwork for the 60s women's liberation movement. Now this sort of glass half full approach provoked its own half empty chorus. Trey's Women in the War Economy, World War II, detailed the discrimination against women war workers and the way their expulsion was planned by the authorities. The emphasis is on women's need and desire for paid work, and the need for women to have that kind of outside work for developing a liberated consciousness. But it was Patty Quick in her 1975 Rosie the Riveter, Myths and Realities, that laid out the competing mythologies. That old Rosie was a happy housewife, drawn by patriotism into war work, but gladly going back home at the end of the war. The new Rosie was a frustrated housewife who had always wanted to work, only her husband and the rest of the boys, being government, unions, and business, wouldn't let her. But war labor demand meant that she could finally get her chance, and she loved it. And so when the war was over and the boys pulled her out of the factory, she was kicking and screaming. Quick is satisfied with neither of these myths, based as they are on the ideology of the white bourgeois woman, not the typical woman worker. She won't buy those accounts of the dramatic increase in women's labor force participation with the war, since much of the increase could be due to the re-entry of discouraged workers from the Depression years back into the labor force. The war had a major impact on black women's labor force prospects, since not all returned to household work after the war. But in general, the post-war period saw the commodification of housework. Thus, wives worked in the paid labor force to produce the vacuum cleaners, for example, that they'd buy with their wages to speed up the housework. This could only be considered liberating in that double Marxist sense, to be liberated, to be enslaved by the wage. Meanwhile, Tobias and Anderson were publishing their finally argued What Really Happened to Rosie the Riveter, which took up the demobilization question in depth. They argue that women were involuntarily pushed out of their better paying war jobs by returning veterans, which was felt to be reasonable, but were denied fair treatment for their seniority in the layoff lists, which did anger a lot of women. They buttressed their argument with a shocking set of excerpts from union management collective bargaining arrangements, where you see how women workers were sold out by their union brothers as well as management. They detail women workers' resistance, the grievances, the strikes, the demonstrations, but these brave Rosies are condemned to job skid, back to their low-paid pink-collar work. By 1978, Rupp is focusing on the propaganda literature, recruiting primarily white middle-class women into the war industries, comparing the effectiveness of the German and American recruiting efforts. And Hartman, in her survey of the advice literature to women on how to treat the returning veteran, is able to uncover the ideological underpinnings of the demobilization problem. If one believed the propaganda in the women's magazines, the sheer burden of soothing the war-torn souls of the returning veterans looked to be a full-time job for any woman. Milkman's 1980 article, Organizing the Sexual Division of Labor, put women's wartime experience in the broader context of the creation and recreation of job segregation by sex. Again, the unions are party to the process, and women are pushed out of their preferred jobs. Then Karen Anderson came out with her book-length study, Wartime Women, which examined in depth women's experiences in three major defense areas, Baltimore, Seattle, and Detroit. While she notes the tremendous changes women underwent in the relatively brief span of the war years, she is aware of how quickly employers reverted to their pre-war prejudices about women workers. Women emerge as the ideal reserve army of labor, which was not to be needed in a post-war economy, nervous about the unemployment aspects of reconversion. Susan Hartman treads some of the same turf in her 1982 book, although there is more national perspective and there's more coverage of the ideology and popular culture. And then there is Honey's article on class differences in recruitment propaganda, a comparative look at the Saturday Evening Post and True Story. While this is an interesting approach, class differences in readership match certain hypotheses about differences in role prescriptions. For middle-class women, it was okay to strive for equalitarian roles, but for blue-collar women, there is no gender advancement stress. It has some instructive shortcomings. The first relates to her understanding of the function of these magazine stories. As she says, quote, because formula stories are expressions of culturally shared ideas and myths, I felt that they were revealing maps of consciousness. But given that the Office of War Information has been creating all these plots, what we are dealing with in this literature is really propaganda culture and not popular culture. The difference between these two in a period such as this is often the most revealing aspect of the material overall. This distinction will be made further later on. A second problem with her study is her admission that, and I quote, such a study ignores the popular culture of minority women upon whom war work had a dramatic effect. The way in which propaganda, class, and gender interacted with race on a cultural level has yet to be explored. To assume that it is even possible to understand white women's experience of the war without knowing the relevant ideology of race relations is difficult enough. But considering how large the question of minorities really was on the home front, this exclusion is particularly damaging. The problem of trying to deal with the contradictions of the war experience without understanding what was going on with minorities is linked to this problem of not distinguishing between propaganda culture and popular culture. Propaganda was fashioned around the white middle-class woman, so it is not hard to understand why these problems have gone hand in hand. But as soon as you do investigate the war from the point of view of minorities, some different interpretations begin to emerge. To begin with, this focus on legal entitlements to equal treatment becomes a lot less important. Minorities were already used to that gap between paper rights and civil rights that white women had yet to experience to the same degree. Then consider the passage or chapter in almost every one of the war diaries on the question of race relations. And you start to realize the degree to which women had to change their own consciousness of racism and sexism. Women came out of the war with a much higher opinion of women's worth and a much better idea of what women of other ethnic racial groups were like. But the majority of women in this country had never before had such extensive contacts with each other. The most important insight from considering the minority women perspective is on this question of why the Rosie the Riveters lost their footing in the demobilization, while blacks, men that is, were able to hold on to more of the wartime gains. The main difference seems to be that blacks had to struggle for all the rights they got. Blacks let it be known that the price for cooperation with the whole war effort was the end of Jim Crow laws, their civil rights. The mainstream women's movement made no such bargains for their enthusiastic support. It was not a movement making struggles. When gains have to be fought for, they seem more capable of resisting eradication. These insights emerge from an admittedly eclectic set of sources, but it is not always easy to locate popular culture when the Office of War Information has usurped some of the normal channels of expression for its own propaganda. The attempt to explore the contours of consciousness is not a straightforward process. It's more like spreading out all the pieces of a huge jigsaw puzzle on the table, sorting out all the sky pieces from all the tree pieces. So the evidence which follows here is meant to be suggestive and not definitive. Okay, let's look at some of the evidence. Minority women made a remarkable shift during the war in their labor market position, out of marginal farm work and domestic service and into blue-collar or clerical work. This translated into much higher wages and much less isolated working conditions. The proportion of black women workers in domestic service dropped from 72% to 48% during the war. Weekly wages for servants before the war averaged $9, and while that went up to $12 and $20, better money could be made in industry. Wynn cites estimates that the earnings of the average black urban worker went from about $400 to over $1,000 per annum. The overall average female weekly wage by 1944 was $31 compared to a male $54. In light of the war emergency, black women's abandonment of domestic service for defense plant jobs could hardly be condemned by racists, although the Southern press fed rumors of so-called Eleanor clubs, of servants scheming for higher wages. But consider this account, and I quote, Barnesville, Georgia has its own brand of worker fight order issued by the mayor of the town in a circular address to all domestic servants. All domestic servants in Barnesville, according to the NAACP Atlanta branch, are Negroes. The order reads as follows. Those living in the city of Barnesville, whether men or women, who have been employed as cooks and nurses and who are not now employed, will be arrested and prosecuted, and no excuse except a certificate from a physician will be accepted. Those who do not like the terms of this warning must realize that we all, regardless of financial means, must either work, fight, or leave this city. This is the final warning. The police force of the city has been instructed to enforce this warning. So much for leaving domestic service. The move into the better paying job ranks, while backed by paper guarantees of equal treatment, was rarely done without a struggle, if at all. Outright exclusion of black or other minority women, depending on the area, was often the rule. The literature is full of these accounts. This is a typical one. This is just one. I could redo it many. Suit was brought against two war plants, Warner and Swayze Company, and Thompson Products, charging them with refusing to employ Negro women workers solely because of their color. Several Negro women testified. They told how they had gone to training school, learned machine shop work, then applied to the two companies for machine shop work. In each case, they were told that there were no jobs for them, although the companies were at that time advertising in the paper for women workers. During the trial itself, company executives were forced to admit that discrimination did exist. Their excuse for it was that the union or individual white workers had objected to the employment of Negro women, a charge which was hotly denied by the union officials involved. At the end, no one disputed the contention that the employers had ever even attempted to hire a single Negro woman for machine shop work. Nevertheless, the judge hearing the case refused to do anything about it. Thus, for the first time, a court confirmed the often made charge that Executive Order 8802 is completely toothless and ineffective. That was the executive order which said that if your plant was doing war work, you had to have equal employment opportunity. Just to get a sense of how the same incident would get reported in the propaganda culture, consider this excerpt from a war diary of journalist Nell Giles, from Punch and Susie, if you know literature. Here she goes. But the other night, the big boss had something on his mind. He came to our bench, watched us a while, and said, "We are thinking of hiring a few Negro girls. Is that okay with you?" One girl said, "Will they use our toilets?" The boss said, "And why not?" And that seemed to be the answer. I heard no more discussion about it that night, but later I heard that a Negro preacher had called up the boss and made a big fuss because he wasn't hiring more Negro girls. As nearly honest an answer as I could find is that there is a percentage of all races and types to be employed here, and the Negro girl who passes her manual dexterity test and her physical exam will be dealt with just as fairly as any other American citizen. Okay, that's a contrast between the propaganda culture and what was going on. Giles is implying there that liberal-minded management was being rather unfairly pressured by black leaders. All anyone had to do was pass the tests. Yet even a brief look at the detailed division of labor in war plants reveals how black women and all women were very carefully slotted into the industrial pyramid. Erickson's report on the steel industry provides a typical picture. While there were many different types of jobs in any given steel plant, black women were only hired for the lowest ranks in each, if at all. These were mostly at the rank of laborer, and wages were below the male minimum level. This description of work in the ore receiving department is typical. This is straight out of the Women's Bureau report. Quote, "Labor gangs go down into the bottoms of the boats," the ore is coming by boat, "and sweep and shovel up the leavings of ore into little piles for removal with special hoists. A crew of women, chiefly Negro, with a woman gang leader, has been employed for several months, going from boat to boat as needed. When there are no boats ready for cleaning, they are employed around the docks and stockyards as part of the general cleanup labor gang. Only the strong and husky woman who does not mind close association with dirt can be placed on such work." And she goes on. "Quite a few number of women in sintering plants work on dumping the cars of ore and dust, inspecting along the sides of the conveyor to remove lumps of slag and foreign material, shoveling up spills along the conveyor line, screening coal and dust, carrying tests to the laboratory, and so forth. All of the work is classed as labor. Most of the women are Negro, and they are reported as removing as much dirt and materials as men. Siderosis from exposure to such dust may cause pulmonary difficulties, but the workers were not wearing respirators, nor did they wear goggles." And I can cite you more of this. Not only was job segregation more the rule than the exception, black women also faced difficulties using the plant facilities. Hawes reports incidents in the locker rooms and on the company buses. not to mention, of course, the more infamous race riots in Chicago, Detroit, New York, etc. Now, whether you're looking at Harriet Arnaz's Mountain Woman in Detroit, or Chester Himes' Bob Jones in a West Coast shipyard, wherever there was war production, wherever there was a nearby military base, the influx of migrating workers strained the capacity of housing, schools, movie houses, restaurants, transportation, etc. Given the segregated residential patterns of most urban areas, overcrowding was a major problem of daily life. One senses the claustrophobia of wartime America, a claustrophobia both physical and mental, as people learned to watch what they said, and civilian life collapsed into the military model. It is significant that black popular culture seems to have been a lot more assertive than mainstream culture. As Wynn put it, and I quote, white America reacted musically to the war with the bland sing-along ballads and songs of crooners like Bing Crosby and Perry Como. Hits such as White Christmas, the biggest seller of the war, were meant to relieve wartime tension and anxiety and were completely lacking in excitement or emotion. Black music gained an aggressive edge as the blues went electric into what would become rhythm and blues, as various regional styles migrated and melded. Jazz went into bebop, and bebop was not swing. Bebop was jagged, militant, committed music. Flamboyant clothing styles, particularly the zoot suits of the young men, were another form of social assertion. Not only had the black community gotten behind some very effective protest movements, the March on Washington movement and the Double V campaign for victory at home against racism, in addition to victory against the Axis, but the black press was filled with news of that second war. Richard Burns' column, Color Craze, in Negro Digest, reported racist incidents of the no comment necessary variety. Another column, This is the Army, printed apparently humorous anecdotes of black military life, only most had to do with racism in one form or another. As the Fortune magazine researchers found, the black press was filled with black news, not white America's news. I quote, the news is news of Jim Crow regulations. So frequently is the phrase that some headline writers spell it J-I-M-C-R-O. It is news of Negroes winning scholarships, of Negroes in battle, of Negroes denied commissions, of Negroes running for local office, of Negroes sitting on committees with whites, of white men speaking up for Negroes, of white men embarrassed because they have neglected Negroes. And except when it is news thus angled, there is no news of national affairs, of the war, of Congress, of the president, of industry. The Negro press deals single-mindedly with the problems of being a Negro in the US. And that was in Fortune magazine survey. Massive migrations, blacks, southern whites, mountain people from Kentucky and the Ozarks, Chicanos, etc., brought some groups in contact with each other for the first time. The literature is full of these first encounter stories. In The Doll Maker, the heroine Gertie, a Kentucky mountain woman, meets her first black person on her way to Detroit. I quote, the woman's head swung slowly, lifting fully into the light, and Gertie realized she was a Negro. She had never seen a Negro until in Cincinnati they had left their separate places and mingled with the whites. She'd heard Clovis say there were Negroes in town, but she'd so seldom been there, she'd never seen one. This woman did not look the way she thought a Negro would, pure black with great thick lips and mashed down nose. Her skin was brown and full of gleams that made Gertie think of the cherry wood. Her eyes were large below a high, thin-templed forehead, and when she looked at Gertie, all her face and the proudful way she held her head were somehow queenly. But bigger than anything else about her was the joy inside her that curved her lips into smiles and brightened her naturally somber eyes. The two begin a cautious conversation, their children and their curiosity drawing them together. It is the last calm moment for Gertie before embarking on her cavalry, Detroit. These first encounter stories turn up throughout the oral history accounts. Winona Espinosa was training to drive transit buses. Here's how she told it. Quote, in Grand Junction, there were no blacks at all, so I had my first contact with them in San Diego. I remember in transit school, they taught us in a lot of states the colored people had to ride in the back of the bus, and that in California, they could ride wherever they wanted to. I had a lot of colored people get on and ask me if they had to sit in the back of the bus. I guess they came from the South and weren't sure what the rules were. Black accounts of these first encounters emphasize this unwritten but powerful presence of Jim Crow in the supposedly integrated northern and western areas. Sybil Lewis's account of working in California hints at the wide range of hostility encountered by blacks. I quote, "A lot of the people came from Oklahoma, Texas, Arkansas. They had come out here just as I had, looking for a job to make big money. We had all been reared in segregated towns and states. They had never been around Negroes. I had never been closely associated with whites. So as we worked together, we began to experience some of the same things I left in Sepulpa. You'd find, go back to Arky, or go back to Oklahoma, written in the restrooms. And you'd see signs, we'll win the war without you, and you knew what N.I. meant. In talking with some of the white girls at work, though, I found that to say nigger was just a way of life. Most of them had never been near, let alone touched, a Negro. So slowly we learned to work together, but in many ways, California was no different from Oklahoma or the South, because people brought their feelings with them." Catherine Archibald's wartime shipyard analyzes the day-to-day racism in the shipyard she studied, Moore Dry Dock in Oakland, which was mostly aimed at blacks, but also against Slavs, Portuguese, Jews, Okies, Japanese, and others. Unlike the propaganda literature, Archibald makes no attempt at a happy ending. Her personal frustration is obvious. She gives the story of her attempt to talk with Beulah, the classical Okie, which is not only misunderstood, but results in a barrage of racist attacks on Archibald herself. Southern Mirror, Mrs. Archibald talked. Southern rearing had given her an extreme and blatant hostility to the Negro. On the other hand, she was abnormally sensitive to the ridicule which her origin brought upon her. On the morning of the incident, Beulah came to work more than usually agitated. A bystander, jostled in a crowded streetcar, had turned to her and remarked that if only a few of the shipyard Okies would go back to where they came from, there might be room for the people who belonged in California to ride to work in comfort. It was a rude affront, and I was quick to agree that she should resent it. I tried to indicate to unhappy Beulah the similar injustice in her hatred of the Negro. The effort is a failure. Beulah defends her rights to be superior to blacks. Archibald later analyzes the dynamics of this racism. Quote, "Hatred of the Negro was no simple product of chance perversity on the part of the white shipyard worker. It was rather an indisputable constituent of his sense of well-being, and the very foundation on which his estimate of his own importance was erected. His conviction that the Negro was inherently inferior carried with it the assurance of the white man's God-given right to the more prominent place in the sun. Thus, even the most ignorant white shipyard worker, whose post was at the bottom, might, by virtue of racial heritage alone, look arrogantly down on his black-skinned companions in toil. It is no surprise that black women filed over a quarter of the discrimination complaints received by the FEPC from July 43 to December 44. Most scholars of the period agreed that the double oppression of race and sex held back black women significantly. Race and sex were certainly key variables in manpower planning by union and company officials. They decided, often jointly, whether blacks would be hired for particular jobs, whether women would be hired, what the ceiling ranks would be, and so forth. The historical record only reveals the product of these discussions, that pattern of segregation by race and sex which resulted. There are some accounts of this process which have survived in the fiction of the period. In her autobiographical novel of work on the Pennsylvania Railroad, Edith Anderson describes the conferences between the union officials, the Brotherhood of Railway Trainmen, and the railroad owners over manpower needs for the war. Should they hire women or blacks? Quote, "We could hire Negroes," said Marshall, one of the vice presidents, with a shrewd smile. "We've considered it and see nothing against it." Hall, one of the two Brotherhood men, wiping his sweating red forehead with a large handkerchief, demanded, "Who's wasting time now, or are you serious?" "The fact is, I'm not joking," said Marshall. "From our point of view, Negroes would be far more valuable workers than women. We wouldn't have to worry about their hurting themselves in baggage cars or on yard duty. If these jobs were given to Negroes, they would be so anxious to prove themselves that they'd be more efficient than the white men. Their fantasy of hordes of women taking over the railroad was blotted out by the far more terrifying fantasy of Negroes taking it over." Close quote. Ultimately, the company lawyer breaks the union men's suspense by reminding them that black men were subject to the draft too, so they'd have to rely on women. They settle back to work out a separate seniority system so that the lady trainmen won't have to stay when the war is over. Anderson's Wartime Railroad is not only a battle of the sexes, it's a look at women's battles with each other, the suspicions women have of other women, women different from themselves. It is a classic home front experience, the first encounter with others. Women had a lot to straighten out about their own misconceptions about what women were about. All the divisions among women have to be dealt with before women themselves can get an understanding of what sex oppression is about. In what was the women's movement doing all this time? In feminist circles, a break seems apparent between the Lillian Smith, Pearl Buck pacifist feminists and the Mary Anderson, Frances Perkins, Women's Bureau patriotic feminists. While the latter focused on the role of women in the national interest, not on women's interests per se, the former were mounting a critique of war and male chauvinism that made a feminist argument out of Freud's death wish theory. Not only would women not get progress from integration into war work, it would set them.
A lot of work on women workers and all work too. I'm not going to talk about that today so much directly, but instead look at a sort of piece of the story that I think is not receiving really much attention, which is changes that went on sort of in domestic life or whatever, and how that relates to the sort of larger political scene. In regard to a women's movement or the lack thereof, which is what often becomes a problem. I also want to start with a quote. You're going to get lots of quotes today, I guess, between the two of us. This is from a letter to the editor printed in PM, which is a progressive newspaper that was published in this era. This letter appeared the week after VJ Day, okay, right after the war ended. And it's from Lieutenant RLS, that's his initial. I'm home from Europe on a furlough, he said. Where do we go from here, boys? And I have just discovered an unexpected post-war problem we vets are going to have to face. Reconversion of our lives. I've been away from home for pretty nearly 3 years, and my wife, who have no children yet, has been working and living by herself in our small apartment. Now, when I went into the Army, she was not what you would call a clingy vine sort of girl, but it did seem to me she was very feminine. And one of her charms for me was that she did seem to depend on me for a lot of things. I used to worry a lot overseas about how she's going to get along by herself. I just lost my place. But if they ship me off someplace for another few months, disappeared right after VJ Day, but he clearly wrote it before it was clear the war was over, I'm going to stop worrying. She's gotten altogether too damned aggressive. For instance, the other night, just after I got back, we decided to go out on the town by ourselves. This guy's from New York, by the way. We go into a restaurant that she's picked out. I admit I haven't been around enough to know where the good places are, but wait. After we sit down, she calls the waiter over, and she orders the drinks before I get a chance to open my mouth. We both know, of course, that what we want is a dry martini, but why can't she let me give the order? Then she calls for the check, and while I'm reaching for my wallet, pulls the money out of her purse and asks me if I've got enough to pay it. By this time, I'm feeling a little hot about the situation. So when we get out on the street, I flag a taxi quick. We could have walked to the movie, but I thought it was time for me to show I was running things. And then damned if she didn't tell the driver where to go. I was well, it went on like that all evening. I've spoken to my wife about this, and she says she will try to stop being so bossy and independent, but I suppose it will take her a little time to get adjusted. I just thought I would write and tell you about it, and maybe you can put an article in the paper telling these soldiers' wives how we would like them not to behave. Oh, this is a real letter to the editor from PM. Yeah. I mean, you know, he's obviously taking a story out of it too, but it is for real. Anyway, I mean, this obviously points to a dimension of the war experience that I think has, at least so far, received relatively little attention from feminist scholars writing about the period. Partly, of course, because it's very hard to get very good evidence about this until I only have fragments as well, but I just thought I'd raise some general questions that we need to discuss. Hopefully this will provoke somebody to do more serious research on this stuff. As you know, the main focus of interest in this area has been the public sphere, the incorporation of women into war jobs, the provision of childcare, and so on. And the family and domestic life reappears as central in the analysis of the post-war transition, of course, and the sort of obliteration of Rosie, the rise of the feminine mystique, and so on. But actually, we now, I mean, from what little has been written about this, it's very clear that there were quite dramatic changes in gender relations on the home front as well. I mean, in a family of domestic life. Which, paralleling the empowerment of women in the public sphere, was equally fleeting. In other words, it seems like there's a sort of temporary period of, you mentioned this too, between, of growing opportunities and more powerful women at home. And also, you know, in spite of the fact that in sort of material terms, there's a kind of erosion of male power, if you like, or anyway, the growth of more options for women in their own family lives. The society really offered no support for this transformation in cultural terms, other than patriotism itself. In other words, women were encouraged to, you know, keep the home fires burning and all that. But there wasn't any, like there is today, any kind of cultural support for women choosing different ways of life. Instead, actually, conventional prescriptions as to what women should be doing and a certain amount of alarm about family breakdown or crisis due to married women's employment, the sort of backlash that we tend to associate with the post-war years is very much in evidence already during the war. At least that's my picture of what's happened. And if that's correct, I think it raises a larger question, which, you know, I think is poorly understood, and I'm really just going to pose it rather than answer it, which is why the dramatic shift in women's material situation during the war didn't lead to any kind of parallel cultural shift during this period. You know, and more generally, why is it that so-called traditional or patriarchal ideology culture persists or even intensifies alongside a sort of erosion of what's often presumed to be its ultimate basis, that is women's subordination within the family. And obviously that question is relevant not just to the 40s, but to our own time, though there are some important differences which I'll come back to. I think that the sort of standard answer to this question, at least in the Marxist feminist literature, is a sort of functionalist answer that says, and I myself have been exponent of this a long time ago, although I'm not so sure about it now, which says that the ideology of women's place, so to speak, is more necessary when the traditional bonds of male domination are loosened, that you need more, you know, more emphasis than on the notion that women's place is in the home and so on when women go out to work. And that the function of the sort of traditional cultural prescriptions is to ensure that women continue to remain in the home and perform unpaid labor and wives and mothers and so on, in spite of the fact that material circumstances increasingly offer alternatives to that. But I think that's really not a very adequate resolution of the question, that perhaps rather than presuming that patriarchal culture or ideology will always be able to sustain male domination, despite the kinds of material changes that seem to, you know, present a basis for something different, I think we need to look more closely at the historical conditions under which that ideology remains supreme, and also the conditions that generate challenges to it, like feminism. You know, and it seems rather sort of ahistorical and not very interesting to just point to ideology as a sort of black box that explains the persistence of male domination in spite of everything. So I'm not sure I can offer this more nuanced understanding of the relationship between ideology and the actual circumstances of women, but by comparing the sort of wartime transformation of women's relationship to the family and the post-war reconstruction to contemporary events, I think we get at least some insights into that question. What I want to do is just use the wartime case as a way of exploring this broader question. And here's what I'll do. I'll talk a little bit about just the general contours of family change and women's empowerment, if you like, within the domestic sphere. And then I'll just give you some evidence that the so-called feminine mystique that we tend to associate with the post-war period actually is very much around during the war as well, despite the kind of disruption of family life that the mystique celebrates so directly. And then I'll try to make some suggestions about the social and political conditions that sustain this conventional feminist ideology during the war. And really, I think the key thing, and this is very similar to what you raised in comparing women and black, is the absence of a popular mass feminist movement in this period is really critical in both of our stories, actually. Anyway, and I'll just end with a few comparisons and contrasts to the current period, where we see some very parallel changes in women's work and family lives, but with the important difference that there is a women's movement that has, you know, substantial influence. So that's the agenda. In demographic terms, the U.S. entry into the war seemed to, at least initially, have a positive impact on the institution of marriage rather than undermining it. Marriage rates, which had fallen during the 30s for obvious reasons, surged. The average age of marriage fell dramatically. Young women rushed to the altar, anticipating a husband shortage as a result of the war. There were many so-called war brides, women married men they hardly knew. The birth rate rose significantly, although not as much as it would after the war. Very different, obviously, from the contemporary so-called family crisis, but nevertheless, a big change from what had happened before. Despite that sort of initial seemingly, well, it seems like initially the institution of family is being strengthened, actually, as the war goes on, there are many parallels to the situation today. Women's power in the household grows pretty dramatically relative to men's, and it seems clear that that's a lot because of the big increase in women's involvement in the labor force, especially the growing employment of married women and mothers, which is a trend that begins during the war and then, you know, of course, continued much more dramatically more recently. Divorce rates soared during the war. So did the number of so-called female-headed families. As Bettina already mentioned, new realms of sexual freedom opened up. For young people, the possibilities of living independently outside of sort of traditional familial constraints expanded quite dramatically after a period when they had actually contracted dramatically, you know, during the Depression. You know, you could argue that the simple influx of women into the labor force, which of course was happening during this time, including for the first time large numbers of married women, that by itself should have increased women's power and independence and so on in the family. But the wartime circumstances actually amplified the effects of this beyond the, you know, the simple fact that women were employed, because spouses were frequently separated into highly segregated situations, not just at work, but also as a result of military conscription, obviously, on the one hand, and the extensive labor migration that Bettina mentioned also separated many households. Now, on the one hand, the fact that men were in the military, that many men were called into the military, that produced obviously a much greater disparity between the experiences of women and men than in peacetime, and a more rigid sexual division of labor. At the same time, it meant that the absence of men on the home front meant that women enjoyed more power and autonomy there. And again, that was true not just in the workforce, but also in the less visible private world of family life. The letter I started with gives you one example of that from the perspective of a returning veteran. The oral history material, which there's now quite a bit of from the war, gives us some glimpses of what this meant to women. Here's just one example from a woman called Gertrude Pennington. This is a Rosie the Riveter oral history from the film. I mean, it's not in the movie, but collected for the research for the film. She remembers, quote, "Very few men were around," and she's talking about the housing project she lived in during the war. "People did their own cooking, but sometimes women would sit out and back on Saturday nights. We'd buy a bottle, play cards, and sit around and talk. Most women talked about their jobs," just like your story. "All of them were concerned about when their husbands would come home because they knew there was going to be a battle. Some were used to their own paychecks, were independent. When husbands enlisted, they were the sole voice of authority. There was more than one argument, several divorces, all caused by men coming home and thinking they're going to be the law of the land. My sister had that problem. They were divorced within a year and a half after he came home because the kids were used to going to her for permission. She was used to handling the car, paying bills. When my sister's husband came home, she changed. He thought everything would fall in a spot like before, but it didn't. In 1946, just after the war, there were 18 divorces per 1,000 married women, which is double the pre-war rate, and at that time, a record level that was no longer a record." Okay, so only a minority of working women, as we know, were actually Rosie the Riveter. So, you know, that's the most dramatic story. Most women were still in traditional women's jobs. Similarly, I think the experience of change within family life was limited to a particular group of women. This is certainly not everybody's experience. Many contemporaries noted that there was a direct association, as there is today as well, between paid employment for women and divorce. As one court clerk noted, in most cases there were working wives and mothers, otherwise they probably wouldn't choose to go on their own. Although, so, you know, there's that dimension of it. More married women did work outside the home during the war than ever had been the case before in the United States. But 3/4 of married women in the U.S. did not work outside the home. So, you know, we're talking about a limited group. But I think that this experience, even though it was a minority experience, so to speak, that is, it wasn't everybody's experience by any means, still presented a sort of specter of family disintegration. And there's a lot of alarm about it in commentaries at the time. And especially, people were very disturbed, and I think this again parallels more recent events, by the fact that family instability, as they like to call it, was greatest among young women, the latest sort of cohort of entrance into the institution of family and marriage. And this group included most servicemen's wives, and also, as young women were overrepresented among servicemen's wives, and also they were more likely to be in the workforce. Among unmarried young women, also, there were unprecedented levels of so-called sex delinquency, as they called it then. In the first year of the war, arrest rates for girls under 21 rose 55%, with drunkenness, disorderly conduct, prostitution, and other sex-related offenses leading the list of their crimes. There were also the so-called V-girls, V for victory. Much discussed in the wartime media, these were young women who sort of hung around in places where servicemen might be concentrated and aggressively propositioned them. Venereal disease rates raised, especially among teenagers, and there's some evidence as well of increased marital infidelity among young wives in the war years. Of course, you know, I already told you about these marriages being so hastily contracted, it's not that surprising. Some of you might have seen this recent Goldie Hawn movie that sort of shows some of this, which I think is a little corny, but does give some insight into what's called Swing Shift. It was, you know, a regular Hollywood movie not so long ago, like that long, but 2 years ago, maybe a year ago. A majority of the people who migrated, the 16 million people migrated from one part of the U.S. to another during the war years, the majority of them were women. That does not include people who went into the military, obviously, or mostly men. For these migrants, old community ties were severed, and with them, many, if not all, pre-war social and sexual restrictions. In the large cities and the booming war production centers where migrants gravitated, many of them, especially those who were unmarried or separated from their families, did find new opportunities and possibilities of sexual freedom. Alan Berbe's pathbreaking research on the gay experience during the war has sort of demonstrated this, I think, best. He writes about the way in which the sex-segregated war experience opened up new opportunities for homosexual relationships. He said about women, he comments, quote, "Women found a new opportunity to leave male-run households and live in all-female worlds as wage earners working in well-paying defense jobs, wearing men's clothes to do men's work, and living, working, and relaxing with each other. Many women, for the first time, fell in love with other women, socialized with lesbians, and explored the gay nightlife that flourished in the crowded city." And for heterosexual women as well, the war offered all kinds of previously non-existent possibilities for sexual experimentation or whatever. Now, today we associate the kinds of changes I just sort of sketched in family, personal relations, sexuality with feminism and movements for, you know, sexual liberation and so on. Today, that the two coexist, the kind of social demographic trends and so on, and the existence of a movement. And both friends and foes of the women's movement often assign it the credit or the blame, depending on your point of view, higher divorce rates, more open homosexuality, more open heterosexuality, no longer confined to marriage for women. I guess in our own time this issue is, you know, perhaps debatable, but it seems to me that today also feminism acts to reinforce and legitimate changes that are basically rooted elsewhere, in, I would argue, in, you know, in changing material circumstances that open up certain possibilities. during the war, certainly, the disruption of traditional forms of family and personal life occurred in the absence of anything we could reasonably call feminism. I mean, it's true that there are individual feminists who are still around and, you know, see themselves that way, but they're really of a different generation from most of the people who are going through these experiences and not very influential in the world as a whole, in the country, in the popular culture. And I think it's sort of tempting to, and you know, a lot of people have done this, to sort of reconstruct women's empowerment, not only in the workforce, but also at home, as some kind of feminist achievement of the war years. That seems to me apocryphal. I mean, that just isn't what happened. That actually, and I'll try to show this right now, that the 40s instead saw a strong defense on the cultural level of conventional family arrangements and sexual standards and the sacred traditions of women's place and so on, even though there's a big and growing gap between sort of cultural and ideological prescriptions and what was actually happening in women's lives. As I said before, the sort of back, what we think of as the post-war backlash against women's wartime incorporation begins well before the war is over. The rise in divorce rates, juvenile and sex delinquency, and sexual promiscuity were repeatedly cited as the price to be paid for the massive movement of women, especially married women and mothers, into the labor force. This was all, you know, clearly considered to be necessary to win the war, but the social consequences of it made it unacceptable to most, you know, social commentators, except as a temporary emergency measure. Ideologically, women's war work was, as the literature and popular culture that Bettina reviewed earlier demonstrates quite well, women's war work was clothed in the flag. It was presented as an extension of domesticity, not an alternative to it. That's not the reality, of course, for men and women, but the ideology was you work to help uncle, you know, the woman behind the man behind the gun, right? I mean, that was what it was all about. And the fact, of course, that working class Rosies had been in the labor force before the war and would continue to be afterward was completely unacknowledged in the popular culture, as you, I thought, demonstrated quite well. You know, as far as that world showed it, and the film about Rosie the Riveter, I'm sure many of you have seen, also shows it very effectively, all Rosies were middle class women who were working for patriarchy and so on. Social workers and sociologists filled many pages of professional journals, which at that time had more of a real connection to what's actually going on in the world than they seem to today, with articles on the threat to the family presented by wartime development. The magnum opus of the pro-family professionals, Lundberg and Farnham's popular neo-Freudian treatise that some of you probably have seen, Modern Woman, The Lost Sex, which appeared just after the war ended. It was published in 1947, but was clearly forged in the crucible of concern which the war provoked. And meanwhile, as we know from the literature and popular culture during the war, there's this unrelenting effort to reconcile the wartime role of women in the workforce with their traditional domestic position and, you know, unrelenting assurances to the nation that in the post-war, the threat to the family that, that you know, Rosie the Riveter's specter has unleashed is going to vanish. There's also a strain within wartime popular culture that, that kind of gives expression to a special version of the old double standard in terms of sexuality. A lot of sympathy for the laxity of soldiers and condemnation, at, on the other hand, of the victory girls and the lonely soldiers' wives who indulged in any kind of sexual infidelity. This is emphasized, as you, some of you may have read Susan Hartman's now classic, I think, essay on the literature. On women's obligations to returning veterans, which has these famous prescriptions for Penelope, if you remember that. And there really was no significant, visible, you know, lasting isn't fair. there wasn't any significant opposition to this sort of celebration of the conventional family arrangements at this time that was in any kind of public arena. Obviously, lots of people made individual choices that defied the prescription. There were some voices heard, though there weren't very many of these either, defending women's rights to post-war jobs, but even the people who were most ardently defending women's job rights never challenged the cultural consensus in regard to family and sexuality. On the contrary, they bolstered their defense of women's right to post-war employment by pointing out that women's earnings were in fact vital to family support, and we heard an example of this from Bettina already. The idea that women should have the right to work for its own sake the same way as men should was not legitimate at this time, and certainly even less so was the assertion of women's right to self-determination in the personal sphere, and that just simply was not in the card. Instead, the actuality of women's empowerment in the family and women's new sexual freedom existed, you know, at the price of cultural illegitimacy. So you could do these things, but there was no cultural support for them. And, you know, part of the problem, of course, was that this period occurs between the two waves of feminism, right? The feminist movement of the 19th and early 20th centuries had become fragmented and really pretty much invisible by this time and had no real social base. Anyway, as you all know, this generation of feminists had at least publicly been quite conservative on these kinds of issues anyway, of family and sexuality, even when they did represent a significant social and political force. And had they survived into the 40s, who knows? I mean, they could have embraced the dominant pro-family cultural view themselves. The second wave of feminism, which of course did challenge this consensus, was not yet to emerge for quite a while. Nor did the left or the union movement, which were both quite strong, unlike the women's movement in this period, offer any kind of political support for personal freedom for women. Insofar as they were concerned with women's issues at all, these movements were pretty much narrowly confined to seeking economic equality for women. The labor movement was still very much steeped in the ideology of the family wage, which equated family cohesion and working class power, and the left never really challenged this idea. There really was just no political space for a politics of personal liberation at this time, for either women or men. Just before the war, the family wage ideology had actually been strengthened considerably by the experience of the Depression. People felt like if there was, you know, if there were going to be all these men unemployed, then women shouldn't be in the workforce. That would make it harder to support families and so on. And of course, many people feared that after the war there'd be a return to Depression conditions, and so that specter was right there. It was hard enough to get support for women's for sexual equality in the labor force under these circumstances, and virtually nobody ventured onto the unfamiliar at that time, you know, terrain of asserting women's rights to personal and sexual freedom. I don't mean to suggest that nobody ever had done that before, but in this period it was part of what was acceptable in public culture. It's not very easy to reconstruct what women themselves wanted during this period, and after all, the war is, you know, even though a very dramatic period, it's a few years. So when women found themselves with new possibilities and new choices, obviously many did seize the opportunities of the moment, but we don't really know what that meant. We know from polls taken at the time that women wanted to stay in their war jobs, but the polls never inquired into the personal ramifications of that. Again, that's another example of a sort of reflection of the fact that the issue was not a legitimate topic of discussion. It wasn't defined as the personal and political as an insight that came later. Okay. I feel like I'm repeating myself a lot, but it's just to, you know, emphasize this point. Instead of any kind of ideological or political vehicle for defending the new personal possibilities that were sort of fleetingly available during the war, the post-war world, as you know very well, was reconstructed along pre-war lines. Wives were reconverted along with the rest of the society. Our lieutenant that we started with hoped they would be. Although, you know, there were all these post-war divorces and so on an individual level. Not until the 60s would we see a political movement giving expression to women's desire to define their lives in different terms than those offered by the feminist movement. So, you know, I think what this leads to is, in terms of contrasting the period of the war years with today, that is that although the sort of material changes are really very similar, in lots of ways the war does anticipate what's happened since the 1960s in terms of changes in work as well as family. The crucial difference, I think, is that in the 1940s there was no legitimacy for alternative lifestyles, if you like. Today, I think the most impressive achievement of the women's movement, in some sense, and I don't know if the women's movement can take all the credit for this, but at least some of it, is that it has successfully challenged the sort of cultural consensus on these issues. If gender inequality remains largely intact, it doesn't have the legitimacy it previously enjoyed, and I think that feminists can take credit for. but just the existence of feminism as an oppositional ideology and as a political movement, while, you know, it's often seen as a response to the sort of gap between the traditional ideology of what women are supposed to be doing and the changing reality of women's lives, what we learned from the 1940s is that there's nothing automatic about that, about that kind of political response. Despite in the 40s a much more rapid incorporation of married women into the workforce, accompanied by trends in terms of, you know, divorce rights and other indexes of family change, very much like those that have occurred more recently, no ideological or cultural, no oppositional ideology emerged in this period. And so I guess what I think that raises, I'm really going to end with a question, is that, well, obviously we have to take seriously the importance of structural shifts in women's economic role. The incorporation of married women into paid work might be a necessary condition for the emergence of the kind of oppositional culture that exists today around personal life questions. It's not a sufficient condition for the emergence of that, as I think the war experience shows very clearly. And I guess I think that means that we need a much more complicated analysis of the sources of power, of the power of traditional ideology about women's role. An analysis that takes into account not simply economic factors, but also social and cultural and political forces, which, you know, I think would both illuminate the reasons for the famous break between the war and the post-war reconversion periods in the 40s, and may also help us understand why today, despite the existence of a popular consciousness that's very sympathetic to feminism, if not identified as feminist, traditional ideology remains as powerful as it does. I'm just going to stop there. I can probably take my notes out, but and I guess we'd both be happy to answer questions. I don't think there's any people who change your payment.
Well, I think there's some an hour of.
Oh, okay. Let's do that. Yeah, it looks like it is almost.